Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly magazine about medicine and health. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is made possible by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, Indiana's premier urban health and life sciences campus. IUPUI, what matters, where it matters. This week, a special hour on what America's addiction to prescription pain drugs is doing to patients.
And they prescribe me Percocet and OxyContin and then hydrocodone.
To newborns.
So on a daily basis, I would have 10 to 15 babies in the nursery. Three of them would have withdrawal.
To doctors.
We did what we were told, and the overdose rate has increased every year that we've had measurements for 11 years.
And to all of us.
We're talking about a death toll that has now exceeded the death of Americans due to car accidents or even suicide.
Finally, the nation is waking up to opioids.
The cost to American society for prescription opioid abuse was about $70 billion.
And this epidemic has literally happened on our watch in 10 years.
I'm Barbara Lewis. Join me for this special edition of Sound Medicine, coming up right after the news. From the Indiana University School of Medicine and WFYI Public Radio Indianapolis, this is Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Happy New Year. Sometime in the coming months, the FDA is expected to finalize new rules to make it harder to obtain some addictive painkillers known as opioids. You've heard of them for sure. OxyContin, hydrocodone, Vicodin. The FDA is responding to the epidemic of prescription narcotic abuse by issuing new limits on how pain pills are doled out. Soon, patients will have to take the prescription into the pharmacy rather than have a doctor call it in. And there will be limits to the number of refills a person can get without a follow-up doctor's appointment. These rules have been a long time coming, and as we first reported last June, after more than a decade of handing out prescription pain medicines as if they're a cure-all, the nation's healthcare community is finally waking up to opioids. Dr. Andrew Chambers is a board-certified addictionologist. There aren't many of them around, a psychiatrist with years of additional training in the diagnosis and treatment of all sorts of addictions.
The rate of increase in prescriptions has also gone along with a rate of increase in lethal overdoses. We're talking about a death toll that has now exceeded the death of Americans due to car accidents or even suicide.
Now, Chambers teaches medical residents and works at an urban mental health clinic that sees a lot of people with addictions. He's becoming one of the Paul Reveres of the epidemic of prescription pain medications. He is warning his colleagues that the medicines they are prescribing for chronic pain are actually causing more problems than they're solving.
But what we've had over the last 15 years is this new phenomenon of prescription opiate dependence that now has grown to be 4 to 5 times more common than heroin addiction.
These prescription painkillers are called opioids because they are either made from the opium poppy or a synthetic cousin. Brand names such as OxyContin, hydrocodone, Percocet, Vicodin, as well as old-fashioned morphine.
The growth of this, I guess you can call it an epidemic, has been amazingly precipitous, on the order of 1,000% increase in the prescription rate of these drugs over a 10 or 15 year period. One of the things that's tough for our field is really understanding at what point does a pain problem and a medication problem become its own disease.
Dr. Deborah McMahon sees the same issue through a wider lens. She leads the public health department in Allen County, Indiana, home of Fort Wayne, a city of 250,000 people. She's part of a statewide task force trying to stem the tide of prescription drug abuse and accidental overdoses.
We're estimating now that 1 in 5 teenagers are using prescription drugs for non-medical purposes.
When she says non-medical, what she means is kids taking somebody else's pain medicine. Maybe they bought it on the street. Maybe they swiped it from a family medicine chest. Either way, the cost to the individuals, to all of us, is staggering.
And it's not just the people taking prescription pain pills who are suffering. Dr. Paul Winchester is a neonatologist. Part of his job is caring for infants born to mothers who are addicted, like this baby, born earlier this spring.
My colleagues and I, and across the state, have experienced a 3,900% increase in the number of these babies in just 10 years. So on a daily basis, I would have 10 to 15 babies in the nursery. Three of them would have withdrawal. A baby that's experiencing this will frequently look pretty good right after birth. And these are typically full-term babies, so they're not deformed or defective in any way.
Often the hospital will get a heads up that the mom is addicted, so the neonatal intensive care unit is prepared to care for the newborn who has opioids in his system. Symptoms don't show up immediately.
Typically the second or third day, the baby begins to be extremely jittery, and the cry can now be recognized as high-pitched and constant. The baby can no longer suck a bottle. You know, it almost acts like he's biting the bottle instead of sucking. And the irritability can be so extreme as to look like a seizure.
Dr. Winchester says he used to see one of these infants a year. Now, he may see one infant a week. And he was caring for three addicted infants when we spoke with him.
So I began to ask, again, as an epidemiologist, how did this start? I mean, we saw in our study that the increase in addiction and adverse outcomes perfectly paralleled the increase in prescriptions. So that means that doctors have increased the amount of pain medicine they've been prescribing. And the question is why? I'm there treating the baby, and I can make myself into an expert at treating the baby, which I'm trying to become.
And it sounds like the circumstances are forcing you to become if you see so many addicted babies.
It's a sad expertise to acquire.
Later in the program, you'll hear from the mother of one of Dr. Paul Winchester's tiny patients. Dr. Palmer Mackay is a pain specialist. He worked for years in a hospital emergency department and now leads an integrative pain management program. It helps wean people with chronic pain off prescription drugs using other treatments, such as acupuncture and physical therapy. He sees a lot more pain drugs, but not necessarily more pain control.
When you look at the amount of resources which have been brought to bear on chronic pain, billions of dollars every year, more injections for the spine, more surgeries, and more opioids prescribed. But when you look at the outcome data, the level of patient satisfaction, indeed even the amount of pain control, is really no greater today than it was before all of these resources were brought to bear.
It's important to note that we're not talking about pain control for people with illnesses such as cancer. The concern here is the treatment of both chronic pain, such as an aching lower back, and the more acute pain, the kind you have after a surgical incision. When we're hurt, a nerve sends a signal to our brain. Think of an opioid drug like a toy Lego. It clicks onto that receptor, fitting it just right so the pain signal is stopped. Until the drug wears off, at least. We met a woman whose addiction to prescription pain medicines began 10 years ago after a fall. She asked that we call her Karen.
I had slipped and fell on some ice and actually broke a bone in my back, chipped a bone, and they prescribed me Percocet, and they prescribed me OxyContin, and then eventually they prescribed me hydrocodone.
Now, Karen is in her 30s and has three teenage children. Back when she was in nursing school, she heard stories about people who became addicted.
We'd even had someone, a former nurse, who would come in to speak to us about addiction to painkillers and how common it is in healthcare. And she had just talked to us about it. And even then, I'm thinking they want to use it because it makes them feel good. I wasn't thinking in terms of that it actually changes your body chemistry where you feel like, or you do have to have it in order to just function and feel normal.
For a while, Karen's doctor willingly refilled her prescriptions for opioid pain medicine.
I took it every single day because I was in pain every single day. that I couldn't function without it. And everything in my life revolved around it.
Pretty soon, a person taking opioids needs a higher dose to achieve the same effect. Again, pain expert Palmer McKay.
Over time, and it's not really much time at all, over a 4-week period, they begin to experience what's called tolerance, which is a decrease effect from that medicine. Even more than that, they begin to experience something called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which is a fancy way of saying the pain medicine is making you experience more pain.
At first, the symptoms of the returning pain are virtually the same as the symptoms of drug withdrawal.
So they become a victim of the treatment. And what's more than that, they get fooled by the treatment, because if they go to stop it, they immediately experience greater pain and assume that the pain medicine was hurting, because the first sign really of withdrawal is a bad feeling in the body.
Karen started worrying that she might be getting too comfortable taking the drugs.
The pain got better, and so I had decided to not take it anymore, to try to just do without the pain medicine, and I didn't get my prescription refilled. It was still at the pharmacy, and I was in school at the time. I went to school, and that day I felt like I had the flu really bad. I was shaky and vomiting, a lot of stomach problems. Had no idea what was wrong with me. I just thought I had the flu.
But when she told her doctor that she was worried she might be dependent, she wasn't prepared for his response.
When I mentioned to him that I was going through physical withdrawal when I stopped, he just stopped prescribing it. There was no help coming from him. He's like, oh, you are? Okay, cut you off. No more. See you later. When I was first prescribed it, it was so easy. He just freely gave it to me. He never once mentioned, hey, only take it, when you absolutely need it, or try not to take it every day, or you can become physically dependent on this medicine. Never once was that ever mentioned. I just feel like he left me hanging. Like, I didn't know where to go or what to do, and he just did his part to cover his own behind, is how I felt. Like, oh, I'm not going to prescribe these anymore. You won't be getting them from me. And just washed his hands of me.
By then, Karen was a nurse working in a healthcare facility. She started to swipe physicians' prescription pads and forge her own refills for painkillers.
I never stole from, like, my patients, but the medicine that would get discontinued on a daily basis, narcotics, were supposed to flush them down the toilet, and I was just taking them home. I was doing it so much, though, that I got confused and didn't know where I'd been or what I'd said. And at the same time, I'm also under the influence and got myself ran up. And that was just so out of character for me. I was never in trouble with the law or anything like that. I was a functioning addict. I was, I had a career. I had a home. My kids were great. Life was great. And people just didn't know that I was taking pills. Like I'm hiding in the closet popping pills, and they would have never suspected it out of me. And so when it did come out, my family and friends were just shocked that I had been doing it and been doing it for so long without anybody knowing.
The low point for Karen came when her utilities were cut off.
And when it got to the point to where it was either the drug or the utilities, and I chose the drug, that was it for me.
Did you hear that? Back when she started taking prescription pain pills, Karen called it medicine.
And so I had decided to try to just do without the pain medicine.
By the time she realized she couldn't stop, she was calling them drugs.
It was either the drug or the utilities, and I chose the drug.
This story has repeated itself all over the country over the past 15 years. The explosion of prescription opioid pain medicine has created too many addicts to count.
The cost to American society for prescription opioid abuse was about $70 billion. That goes through the loss of productivity, which is the largest loss, as well as various forms of liver disease, cognitive dysfunction, and the bone disease. So the mortality and the cost are absolutely profound. About 15,000 people lose their lives because of prescription opioid abuse.
In 2010, 16,651 Americans died from an overdose of prescription pain medicine. That's more than died from heroin and cocaine combined. It's nearly two deaths every single hour. Or as one doctor described it, three 9/11s per year. So, how'd we get here? That part of the story is next. You're listening to Sound Medicine. Underwriting for Sound Medicine is provided by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, Indiana's premier urban health and life sciences campus, IUPUI. What matters, where it matters. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. We're taking the full hour this week to explore the explosion in opioid addiction, people who start taking prescription pain medicine and end up addicted to narcotics. Now, they're waking up to opioids. So how did it all begin? What many call an epidemic of addiction began with a subtle change in how the medical field looked at pain. Back in 2000, a nonprofit group that accredits hospitals and healthcare organizations, which has an unwieldy name and the acronym JCO, issued a mandate that pain be measured like other vital signs and treated. Hospitals that didn't follow the mandate could lose accreditation and funding. The JCO report was co-published by the National Pharmaceutical Council, an industry trade group. And it was endorsed by the American Pain Society, made up of pain physicians. Around the same time, Congress announced that the next 10 years would be the decade of pain control and research. So now, when a nurse checks a patient's blood pressure, temperature, pulse, and respiration rate, there's one more mandatory question. Do you have pain? And because pain is entirely subjective, a doctor must take a patient's word for it. So one person's annoyance might be another person's agony.
We don't have a measure which says, Barbara, I'm sorry that your pain is a 5 that you tell me, but actually you're only having a 2. Right? We have to accept the reports of the pain from the individual.
Pain specialist Dr. Palmer Mackay remembers the pressure he came under almost immediately.
We had to change the way that we did things in order to receive accreditation from JCO so that the pain management and measurement were two parts of that process which had to change.
Doctors were instructed that pain needed to be better controlled and that
we were under-treating pain and that the primary treatment modality is opioids and that we should use opioids until there is adequate pain relief or there'd be intolerable side effects.
The pressure to treat pain came from all sides. For one thing, patient satisfaction ratings were becoming more common. So a physician who refused to treat pain by prescribing strong drugs risked getting a negative rating, which could affect both pay and job security. And though there are other ways to treat pain, including non-prescription drugs, powerful analgesics work faster. So very quickly, opioid drugs became the treatment of choice.
And since the easiest treatment modality, the one that was thought to be most efficacious, was opioids, we started to use higher and higher doses of opioids. It concerned me, but at the same time, I was beginning to follow that belief system that using higher opioids worked. And why wouldn't I believe it? The experts of the country told us that it was safe.
That assurance of safety meant a lot. Dr. Mackay recalls a paper in a top medical journal which told physicians that prescribing opioids for pain management posed, quote, a very low risk of triggering addiction.
And it turns out now that that quote was more than a little bit incorrect.
It turned out that there really wasn't much evidence to back up the promises of safety.
We were told by the pain leaders, many of which have stepped forward over the last 2 years and made public apologies, that they didn't realize how little data there was to support their contentions and have, in the New York Times and in other press, said we were wrong. And if you look at some of the literature around the American Pain Society recommendations of 97, around the pain control and research, and around JCO, you will find the pharmaceutical companies embedded, enmeshed within that.
When one of the best-known opioids, OxyContin, came on the market in the late 90s, its manufacturer, Purdue Pharma, promoted it as nearly addiction-proof. But in 2007, the company was fined $635 million in penalties for misleading promotions about safety. Now a Senate committee is investigating whether there are any financial ties between the manufacturers of pain drugs such as OxyContin and Vicodin and the nonprofit doctors groups that focus on pain management.
Then you had the workhorses, all the primary care doctors who were being told by the federal government, the American Pain Society, American Association of Pain Medicine, and the governing bodies that not only is it safe, there's very little risk of addiction, and it'll work. And the impact of all that was that we did what we were told. And the overdose rate has increased every year that we've had measurements for 11 years.
Whether the drugs come from a doctor or stolen from a relative or bought on the street, the impact of addiction is inescapable. Last year, there were 1.2 million drug-related visits to emergency departments involving people taking opioids that had not been prescribed for them. Those numbers now have the attention of policymakers and doctors whose practice centers on pain management.
The pendulum is definitely swinging the other direction at this point.
Dr. Michael Whitworth has a pain management practice in Columbus, Indiana. Opioids, he says, are never the best option for pain.
But sometimes they're the only option that remains available. Most patients will require very modest escalations, but generally it has to be based on educating the patient what the role of opiates are. And they're not to make them pain-free, but they're to enhance their function. When all other conservative measures have failed or are not likely to be successful, within using a trial of opioids might be a means of testing out whether opioids might be an appropriate therapy. So opioids are used conservatively, and they're certainly not a first-line approach in the management of pain.
In fact, there's considerable research coming out now that opioid drugs really don't help much with chronic pain, although they do help with the kind of pain you might have right after an operation or injury. For addiction specialist and psychiatrist Andy Chambers, the past decade has been alarming. Not only have patients lost their lives to prescription drug overdoses, doctors have started realizing that their good intentions were partly to blame.
There could be some realization that now an addiction has set in, and the realization could be expressed between the patient and the physician. And now the physician may acknowledge that, in fact, there is an addiction. But again, that doctor is not trained, because doctors generally aren't trained this way.
Dr. Chambers says that many people who are hooked on prescription drugs seem to be fairly functional.
If someone's been on opiate narcotics for 5 years in a pain program, they may well be addicted, even when they haven't done something behaviorally to raise the eyebrow of the clinicians. You know, there may be a steady pattern of opiate consumption, no illegal activity, but that person could be very, very addicted. Because on the one hand, from a chronic pain perspective, the drug that they may be addicted to is a therapy. Mm-hmm. It's actually a medication. It's something they should have and they need. And from the other model, it's something that is an alien force that's destroying them.
Dr. Michael Whitworth has been following the statistics and is in touch with state lawmakers who are changing the prescription regulations.
Therefore, we're constantly tweaking and adjusting things to make them safer for patients, and then passing on those to the state's pain physicians so that they will have that knowledge also. We examine coroner's reports from around the state when they're available. I do medical legal work, so I get to see the toxicology reports, and so I can make some assessments about what might be the causation of death and overdose in patients.
And as you heard in the hospital nursery, the people who die from an overdose are not the only victims. Sound Medicine reporter Jill Dittmeyer visited a neonatal intensive care unit where it's not unusual for a third of the newborns to be going through withdrawal because their moms are addicted to prescription drugs.
Baby Jerry is just a few days old and already a drug addict.
Babies get very jittery, they cry, very irritable, not consolable. Perhaps the most dangerous thing is they can't eat well. And in fact, many of them lose their ability to suck and swallow. They're just, it's as if their jaws are just too tense and they can't swallow.
Dr. Paul Winchester oversees the St. Francis NICU and says the number of opiate-addicted babies he and the NICU nurses treat is on the rise.
In 2001, if you had walked in here on any given day, you would have seen none. We would have one or two cases a year. And now we have three cases a day.
And what is more alarming is the type of drugs they are addicted to.
I think it's really important to point out some of the findings of our study, which are that the vast majority of these addictions are not to opiates like heroin, which are made illegally in, you know, some other country. The prescription opiates are almost all of them were the initial cause of her opiate addiction. The pain medicines manufactured by big pharmaceutical companies.
I'm actually the seventh generation alcoholic addict in my family.
Kristen McDaniels just delivered her third baby, a baby who was born addicted.
I am here today visiting my daughter, Catherine, in the NICU, who is being withdrawn off of opiates and benzodiazepines that I was prescribed during my pregnancy.
Kristen's drug addiction started in her teens when she was training to be a ballerina. The intense regimen took a toll on her young body.
And during the pain, when I was 16, I was using methamphetamine and heroin, and what I was really doing was self-medicating. And my doctor, with my grandfather's help, said, you know, Vicodin works for me, put her on Vicodin. So there, at the age of 16, I was on Vicodin.
At 18, she checked herself into a clinic and cleaned up from the street drugs. But then she was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, which meant prescription pain medication would be a part of her daily routine, even during her three pregnancies.
My doctor knew about my addiction history, and instead of keeping me on such high doses, she weaned me down slowly during the pregnancy, and I was on a very, very low dose of opiates.
The same for her second baby.
He was in the NICU for 48 hours, and that's all it took for him. They sent me home with prescriptions to put in his formula, and we weaned him that way.
But her doctor and protocol were different for her pregnancy with Catherine.
My doctor did not lower anything. Instead of taking 4 to 6 Vicodin 10s a day, she cut me down to 4. But that's still a really high milligram to be on. And instead of the Xanax, she just switched it to Klonopin, but the same milligram. So my baby was born highly addicted to opiates and benzodiazepines, which they're using morphine for the opiate withdrawal, and they're using phenobarbital for the benzodiazepine withdrawal.
Dr. Winchester says it takes up to 6 weeks or more to safely wean highly addicted babies.
So you can imagine a full-term baby that normally would spend 2 days in a hospital in a well nursery instead is spending 6 weeks in an intensive care nursery. One maybe costs $600 a day, the other more like $6,000 a day.
I was not prepared to have my baby be in a hospital for this long and for the wean to take this long due to medication I was given by a doctor and took just like I was supposed to, and look what happened.
Dr. Winchester says even when a baby is successfully weaned from the opiate, its future remains uncertain.
The chemistry of exposure, we now know, imprints their DNA. And if this weren't bad enough that we've changed their lives forever, we now have evidence that these kind of imprints, some of them become heritable. So we may have changed all of their descendants as well.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
If you are interested in more information about this topic, we have resources for you online at soundmedicine.org. And if you have a comment or question about this program, go to our website, again, soundmedicine.org, and click on Contact. After a break, signs that the tide of opioid addiction may be cresting.
When I go to write a prescription, the computer will pop up an alert now and say, JT, this person has a score that's elevated. So it catches me as I'm trying to write a prescription on people that are at high risk.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Sound Medicine is a production of WFYI 90.1 Public Radio, Indianapolis, and the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. This week, we're devoting the full hour to the epidemic of opioid addiction that has embroiled the healthcare industry and forced doctors, pharmacists, and regulators to begin waking up to opioids. Here's one glimmer of encouraging news. In the past 2 years, the number of opioid prescriptions has gone down, not by much, from 243 million in 2011 to 241 million last year. And the news isn't all good, though. Heroin deaths are creeping back up, and it's not clear whether fewer prescriptions translates into fewer actual pills, since the bottles might be fuller. So it's too soon to call it a trend. Still, there are signs that the medical community is getting the message. Pain physician Michael Whitworth says that in recent years, he has transformed how he cares for his patients.
We worry about substance abuse, diversion, and addiction on a daily basis with these patients, and that is why we monitor them. If we detect substance abuse or a chemical dependency, well, then it becomes a very serious issue, and we certainly take action. That is, you don't simply write a 3-month or a 6-month prescription of opioids and then send them along their way. There are many different things that occur in their physiology that may change over a 3-month period. And so you need to monitor your patients very closely for their level of sedation, to make sure that there are no drug aberrancies using the prescription monitoring program, and utilizing monitoring techniques such as urine or saliva drug screens to demonstrate compliance with the policies of the clinic.
The willingness to be more aggressive in pain treatment has meant that many people who weren't being believed before that they had crippling pain now are getting attention. The flip side of that, many of those same people become addicted without their doctors realizing it.
And when a patient comes in and says, I'm doing well on this Vicodin, Barbara, thank you very much for providing it. It may help me even more if I could have 10 more a month. And it's a very superficial kind of exploration of their life. But it's rewarding. They're doing good. And the reflection of that then is that I'm doing good. I'm being a good provider.
Dr. Palmer Mackay remembers when he started writing fewer opioid prescriptions. He describes it as his mea culpa moment because it was clear to him that he was part of the addiction problem. For one thing, he noticed that even though he was providing painkilling drugs that were supposed to help, his patients weren't doing better.
And then when they began to report symptoms of increased pain or increased dysfunction, we would increase the dose again until there are intolerable side effects or until another untoward effect happened, such as an overdose or very clear substance use disorder. In fact, I've had a number of phone calls back in the mid-2000s from patients' wives complaining about erectile dysfunction. So it was about 2004, 2005 that I started to recognize that many of the individuals on high-dose opioids were becoming effectively hypogonadal. That is, their testosterone would tank. And so stacking the lack of functioning and then some of the problems that occurred, whether it's sleep apnea, you know, constipation, mental clouding, fatigue, depression, deconditioning, osteoporosis, increased risk of falls, muscle problems, kind of culminated with my sense that what we were doing wasn't working.
Now, Dr. Mackay and others he trains focus on helping wean a patient off the drugs. It's more of an addiction recovery model, not just pain management.
So that they learn, at least at some level, that there are real complications to what's going on. And we include in that addictions, that even though they don't feel as though their risk is high, the longer you're on it and the higher the dose, the greater the risk of harm.
One thing is sure, says Palmer Mackay, prescribing pain medications requires more oversight than many doctors have the time or training to perform.
And what we've found in our institutions and throughout the literature is that most of the people who are prescribing aren't following the guidelines that were initially recommended. They're not monitoring their patient for mental illness. They're not monitoring their patient using urine drug screens or other screening mechanisms to determine if the individual is taking their medicine, if they're taking illicit or street drugs, or if they're taking other prescription medicine in addition to what you're prescribing. And they're not setting the goalpost. So that is to say that there's no end in sight. How would we define what a treatment success is?
He measures a patient's success differently, too.
And so I started looking at our patients in terms of their hobbies, return to work, return to school, getting up off the couch, collecting their mail every day. And it was apparent that we weren't translating this high-dose opioid regimen into an improved quality of life. It wasn't an epiphany, but it was a relatively rapid transition from the really acute care paradigm, that is, here, take these opioids, move on, and get better, which turns out doesn't happen, to a judicious use of opioids, really, I think, for me, best conceived of as a bridge where there's a beginning and an end.
Around the country, hospitals and healthcare systems are changing as well. In Massachusetts, Blue Cross now requires a more involved process of informed consent, explaining the risks of addiction before writing the first prescription, and then only enough pills for 30 days before seeing the doctor again. Earlier this year, New York City revamped its prescribing guidelines for all of its city's emergency departments. Changes such as limiting the number of milligrams per week, the number of pills, and shortening the time between doctor visits. At IU Health, where Palmer Mackay practices in Indiana, he's making the rounds to its community health centers and revamping the prescribing guidelines to reduce the chance of addiction.
They get it before I even talk to them. And what they get is that so many of their relatives or their neighbors know someone who's been impacted negatively by this opioid problem, that when the conversation is begun, they're already half the way there. So they're starting to meet us on ground that is an easier conversation to have.
More often now, initial screenings for pain management also check for signs of depression and other mental illness which can contribute to addiction. Again, Public Health Commissioner Deborah McMahon.
Healthcare providers need to get better at asking those kinds of questions, and people need to really work on developing insight into themselves, and that is really recognizing depression and anxiety. I just really wonder how much of untreated, undiagnosed mental health issues really contributes to going down a pathway of addiction.
Many of these people are not in any way bad. They haven't done anything wrong, and that's the patient and the provider. They've simply engaged in the dance to the music that was brought to them from all the various regulatory bodies and the societies. And so now we're basically saying, change your dance. And they don't know the steps, they don't recognize the music, and both sides are very, very unsettled with that.
And patients are counseled to make sure they have a more realistic expectation of how much their pain will actually be reduced.
We're trying to get people to engage in their care, to have it really be participatory and not a passive process of simply taking a pill, which ultimately is far more difficult. But when you see the recoveries that are possible and the benefits that are possible, it makes the work a lighter load to carry.
The old model, a patient could often get a refill of strong opioids just with a phone call. Now it's a checkup with the doctor before any more pills are provided. Technology is helping here. At a public safety net hospital in Indianapolis, the in-house electronic medical record system is tied to the state's prescription drug monitoring program, known as INSPECT. Dr. J.T. Fennell is leading a pilot project aimed at making it easier for emergency department and private practice doctors to know what drugs patients are taking.
We actually now use a program called NARCSCheck, and it's sort of like a reverse credit score. And so it's an algorithm that Ohio developed, and it takes all your prescription data and quantifies it into a single numeric result. The higher the score, the more likely you are to have a problem with the prescription.
It's still just a pilot program in one hospital, but doctors there are already relying on having quick access to a patient's drug-taking history.
And so now when patients present to the emergency department, when you show up, we automatically request a data dump from INSPECT. And so we get that report built into our electronic medical record automatically. So when I go to write a prescription, the computer will pop up an alert now and say, JT, this person has a score that's elevated. You may want to look at their INSPECT data. So it catches me as I'm trying to write a prescription on people that are at high risk.
At this point, though, there's no requirement that all doctors check INSPECT first before writing a prescription for opioids. And according to one report, only about 40% of physicians use the system. Addictionologist Andy Chambers says he realized that insurance companies often work at cross purposes with efforts to stop prescription drug addiction. The bottom line is that insurance will pay for pain drugs, but not nearly as much for the time-consuming counseling that is needed to overcome addiction. Also, doctors who work for large group practices are limited in how long they can spend per patient. There's just not time either to counsel a new patient on how to avoid succumbing to addiction or deal with someone who is clearly hooked on opioids. In other words, there's no incentive, and in fact, a real penalty for diagnosing someone with opioid addiction.
What are the medical economics that make it more and more important for physicians to see more and more people in a shorter amount of time and, you know, really see people without getting to know them that well, and quick fixes, prescription of pills being what medical care is about, or rather than the doctor-patient relationship, and where is that in all this, and how has that been a part of why we're facing this epidemic? When we're actually trying to treat someone with opiate addiction, the complicated nature of securing reimbursement for providing that kind of care is a sea change different level of difficulty compared to how easy it is to get reimbursed to actually prescribe a drug for pain without having to do any kind of real documentation around that or vigorous screening, et cetera.
Doctors are also limited in how they prescribe methadone for pain management. It's much less expensive than other opioids and is used in lower doses. And insurance will cover methadone for pain control. But if the patient has been diagnosed with addiction, if that word is in her chart, then it's illegal for a primary care doctor or even a doctor in a pain clinic to prescribe methadone.
So a doctor can prescribe methadone readily for pain in a fairly unregulated way, and it's actually really inexpensive. But as soon as a question or diagnosis of addiction is made, it would be illegal for the doctor to prescribe it unless the patient is in a methadone clinic.
Only doctors who work in addiction clinics may prescribe methadone for addiction treatment. But in that case, insurance won't cover it. Another drug that's being used more often now is Suboxone. Dr. David Crabb has spent much of his career studying how the body deals with addiction. He explained that Suboxone contains a combination of two drugs that calm the craving without feeding the addiction.
If ultimately the goal is simply to detoxify them, shall we say, it in effect works like methadone, but it has fewer drawbacks. It stimulates the receptor enough that a patient who is trying to stop using narcotics, they don't have withdrawal from the drug, but they don't feel euphoria either. So it's kind of a partial agonist, as it's called, partial effect. So if you're taking it as it's prescribed, you don't feel euphoria, you don't have withdrawal, and you don't get a stimulus. So it should help you maintain a steady mood and so on. Methadone partially works that way. But you should be safer in that regard because there's not that inducement to take a higher dose to try to get a high.
Here's where the policy gets even more frustrating. If that person relapses during addiction treatment and takes another opioid in addition to the Suboxone, then Medicaid will cut off future addiction treatment. On the other hand, Medicaid will pay for what sometimes can amount to years of opioids if the diagnosis is pain, not addiction. Bottom line for doctors, it's safer to keep writing pain on the patient's chart.
What I'm not hearing either is, oh my goodness, this is an unintended side effect of the treatment. Here are the colleagues that I work with who actually treat addiction. Let's get you evaluated for that. Here are the treatment centers. Here are the options. Let me pick up the phone. And in many ways, unfortunately, they're not coordinated or integrated with primary care docs.
Remember Karen? She felt the shortage of addiction services firsthand.
Someone who's active in their addiction, I mean, they may really, really want to stop. When you call up somebody to get help and you pick up the phone and you want that help right then and there, and then they tell you your appointment is 3 months away.
When Karen was caught forging her own prescriptions, she lost her nursing license. Now she works as a dog groomer and is in treatment. She took methadone for a while, but since that's not covered by insurance, she had to pay $250 in cash every week.
In the early months of treatment, you have to show up 6 a.m., early in the morning, 6 or 7 a.m. every morning. You're generally not given scripts. You're given the med at the clinic every day.
You stand in line at the window to get your medicine. You take it right there at the window.
After a while, that proved to be too much. She had a relapse. Karen is doing better now, but the memory of how far she fell is still sharp.
It sounds innocent enough, but what it does to you, it turns your entire life upside down. I mean, when it's so hard to imagine what it's like to be a slave to this drug.
Dr. Chambers and Public Health Commissioner Dr. Deborah McMahon agree the medical community bears a huge responsibility for helping end the epidemic.
We truly believe that it starts with educating the physicians and really equipping them to make choices for the patients that are really more appropriate in the 21st century. And the problem is, it's not that simple to make pain go away. And actually, I'm not even sure that's the goal that we should be looking for most of our patients. Really, what we want people to do is be functioning in their life, doing the things that are meaningful to them. And they may have to do it with some pain. We can't prescribe away all pain for folks. So I think that's the real trend that I've seen, is getting away from helping people lead a functional, productive life to trying to assist people in living a pain-free life. And I'm just not sure that's practical.
Andy Chambers says he has occasionally confronted the doctors who have prescribed the drugs for patients who end up in his addiction clinic. Sometimes they're grateful for the information, but not always.
Because doctors don't want to look at the possibility they could be creating a problem, often the patients get blamed rather than the drug or the prescribing practice. The patient gets blamed. You screwed up, not me.
Palmer Mackay says that when he coaches doctors to cut down on their prescribing of opioids, he gets some resistance. They tell him,
you can't take away the only tool in our box that can address the chronic pain problem. You can't just leave us empty-handed and expect us to be okay with that. It's very unsettling to the physicians. But if you step back again, and I've been in part guilty of this, of believing that what I'm doing is helping because I'm not seeing harm. It will take, unfortunately, some people to retire, and it'll take some people to see additional data and additional death, additional devastation from addiction before they're willing to fully identify the problem that opioids have caused and begin to extricate themselves from those practices.
Still, the pressure is on doctors from multiple directions. Neonatologist Paul Winchester.
Well, if you were to interview any emergency room doctor or family doctor around the state, you would get the same answer from all of them. They would say, I am being evaluated now by the organization that certifies my hospital by how well I treat pain. And if my patients leave here and complain that my pain care is substandard, my hospital will lose its accreditation.
There's a mythology out there that if you're a physician prescribing it and the indication that you're writing down on the chart is pain, then that kind of magically protects. So it's almost hard to see addiction when you're trying to prescribe the drug for good reasons.
So it's back to the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. What began as a sincere attempt to help patients by making their pain go away did do harm. For doctors who got into the profession to help people, the news that they might have caused real damage is unsettling.
Of course we all care about alleviating pain. But we have to remember that opiates are the single most addictive drug we know that you can give to humans. It's way more addictive than tobacco. And we know how that ended.
It's pretty scary for physicians to think that they could be doing something harmful when their intentions are all good.
The feeling that you've been lied to, you've been misled, and now you have to go and tell your patients that you have lied to them, when in actual fact, you know, it's not a lie, it's a new truth that we understand now.
There's no happy ending to the story yet. But at least for now, this epidemic of addiction is getting more attention. And finally, doctors, patients, and the health industry at large are waking up to opioids. That's it for this special edition of Sound Medicine. This week's program was written and produced by Nora Hyatt, with help from Eric Metcalf and Jeremy Shear. It was recorded and edited by our engineer, Chris Lieber. Our website is managed by Sydney Willman. Our executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health. Thanks for listening. This free podcast was underwritten by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, Indiana's premier urban health and life sciences campus. Sound Medicine is a production of WFYI Public Radio in Indianapolis and the Indiana University School of Medicine. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.